Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 11.
Today we're getting into something really fascinating, Chapter 11, and it's all about Emperor Taizong of the Tang Dynasty. Well, his supposed trip to the underworld. It's packed with these really vivid descriptions and gives some great insights into beliefs about morality.
Oh, definitely. The whole moral and spiritual framework of the time.
So our mission today, basically to unpack the key events in this chapter, we want to understand what it tells us about, you know, historical views on life after death, ethics, even the emperor's role, and pull out the most interesting bits for you all.
Let's dive in.
Okay, let's start right after Emperor Taizong's supposed death. What happens? Where does he find himself?
Right. So the story goes, he finds himself with two figures from the underworld. There's Trio Her, or Judge Qi. He's kind of an official in charge of judgments. And military commissioner Zhu, a military guy down there. And together, they take him to see the UI.
The six paths of reincarnation. That sounds important.
It is. It's really central. Judge Kuei actually explains it all, the different kinds of rebirths people face, all based on, you know, what they did in life.
Okay, so what are these paths? What determines where you end up?
Well, Judge Kuei breaks it down. He says, doing good deeds that leads you to the path of immortals.
Immortality way.
Then there's loyalty, especially to the emperor that gets you Usho, rebirth into nobility. A good position.
Makes sense for an emperor to hear that one.
Right. Then filial piety, you know, respecting your parents, leads to a path of blessings and good fortune.
Okay.
Harley fairness, being just that, gets you back to whole, the human realm, just being reborn as a person.
So being fair keeps you human. What else?
Then Sud, which is like accumulating virtue through good acts. That leads to Huthor, rebirth into wealth.
Interesting. So virtue equals wealth in the next life.
Seems like it. And then predictably, wickedness, pure evil well. That leads to a few falling into the realm of ghosts.
Yikes. Pretty clear system of cause and effect then. How did Emperor Taizong take all this in?
The text says he totally got it. He, like, recognized that good is rewarded, evil is punished, and that divine justice is, you know, unavoidable. He even says something like, good deeds avoid disaster, good thoughts bring rewards, avoid evil, because divine payback is certain.
So even the emperor is under this cosmic law.
Exactly. It suggests nobody's above it.
Okay. So he's learned this lesson. Now he's about to head back to the world of living. Does Judge Kuei have any final instructions for him?
He does. A really important one. Judge Kuei tells him he must hold a water and land assembly when he gets back.
Water and land assembly. What's that exactly?
It's a major Buddhist ceremony. The idea is to deliver salvation to unsouled spirits, you know, ghosts who died without proper rites or are suffering.
Okay. A spiritual duty.
Right. And the judge also says, you know, promoting good deeds back in the living world will bring peace, help his dynasty last longer, keep the empire stable. It's kind of a mix of spiritual work and good governance advice.
A task list from the afterlife. So let's get to his return. Back at the palace, the White Tiger Hall things must have been pretty tense. Everyone thinks he's dead.
Oh, completely tense. You've got the Crown Prince, the Wombanus Empress, all the concubines, officials. Everyone's deep in mourning.
Yeah.
And there's this split. You have Ia, Wei Xing, the loyal advisor, insisting, no, wait, maybe he'll come back.
Always the faithful one.
Right. But then there's Xia, Xu Jingzong, who's like, come on, dead is dead. Let's move on, sort out the succession. It really shows the political uncertainty his death caused.
You can just feel that tension, grief, politics, and then something impossible happens. Sounds from the coffin.
Exactly. Total pandemonium. The text says officials, generals, they just panic. The empress, the concubines, are shaking with fear. It uses these metaphors like a bridge collapsing, a temple falling down.
Wow.
Just to show the complete shock and disbelief, like the world turning upside down.
I can only imagine. And then they open it. What do they see?
Emperor Taizong is sitting up inside. And the first thing he yells is, I'm drowning. I nearly drowned.
Unbelievable. What did the officials do?
Well, Xu Magong Sub Qing Shubao,
right.
And of course, Wu Zhang. They rush forward immediately. They're like, Your Majesty, what is it? Tell us. Trying to calm him down, showing their relief and loyalty.
So what's his story? How does he explain being dead and then not? What happened on this trip?
He tells them he was summoned by officials from the underworld, taken before the 10 kings of hell.
The big bosses down there.
Pretty much. And he had to face an accusation from the spirit of the Jing River Dragon.
Ah. Yes, that backstory.
Then they checked his lifespan in the wait, the wedged together register of life and death. Turns out he still had 20 years left, so his trip was sort of divinely sanctioned proof he should still be ruling.
Convenient. Did he see anything else down there?
Oh, yeah. He describes seeing sinners being punished, suffering intensely, and he saw the city of A, the city of wrongful deaths, just filled with countless sea, these souls who died unjustly.
That sounds grim.
It does. And apparently, Judge Kui had to borrow a whole load of gold and silver from some guy named Chia, old man Shang, down there, just to appease these angry spirits so the emperor could pass safely.
Borrowing money in the afterlife. To pay off ghosts.
Seems so. It suggests you still need wealth, or at least symbolic offerings, to sort things out down there.
And the drowning part he mentioned. Where did that come from?
He says that after leaving the underworld, when he was near the Wei River, he got distracted looking at some Chen two-headed fish. Kind of weird.
Two-headed fish. Okay.
And just then, that Laka military commissioner Zhu figure, the military guy who escorted him, he treacherously pushed him into the river. So he nearly drowned before his spirit could actually get back into his body.
Whoa. So even a bit of underworld intrigue there. What a story to come back with.
Absolutely.
So the emperor's back. He's had this life-changing or maybe death-changing experience. What does he do first now that he's back on the throne?
Well, his actions show a real shift. First off, he grants a huge amnesty, releases tons of prisoners, including like over 400 who were on death row.
Pardon of death row inmates. 400 prisoners released from jail.
400, yeah. Another significant act.
They still had to, next year today, still face accountability for their crimes. Well, that's significant.
Yeah, and he releases 3,000 palace women, sends them back home, maybe a sign of wanting less attachment, more compassion.
Possibly. What else?
He puts out this big decree, an imperial edict, telling everyone across the land to basically be good, promote virtue, good conduct. There's even a little poem about his virtuous acts, hoping for blessings.
So it seems his trip really did affect his ruling style. What was the main message in that edict?
The core message was about the importance of genuine good deeds, honesty, being thrifty, real compassion. He specifically contrasts this with just being clever or cunning or just going through the motions of religion without meaning it.
Ah, so substance over style. Real virtue, not just looking pious.
Exactly. He's pushing for practical ethics, it seems.
Now, the story brings in someone new, Lu Quan. Who's he and how does he fit in?
Right, Lu Quan. He's described as a rich guy from Jizung, Junzu, and he volunteers for this really dangerous mission to take Zhu melons and fruits, which were apparently valuable, down to the underworld.
Voluntarily goes to the underworld. Why?
It's a really sad story, actually. He's doing it out of guilt. His wife, Liquillian,
donated a pair of golden hairpins to the monks.
Killed herself after he yelled at her really harshly.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So he feels terrible, wants to atone, and maybe even take care of his wife and their kids in the afterlife. It's an act of devotion driven by remorse.
That's heavy. So yeah. How does his trip go? Does he meet the kings of hell?
He does. He gets down there, finds the king of hell.
And present a pumpkin.
The king is super pleased, especially when he finds out they're a thank you gift from Emperor Taizong.
Ah, so Taizong followed through on his underworld connections.
Seems so. The king's impressed with Taizong's integrity, following the judge's instructions. And then he asks Lu Quan about his own story.
And this leads to something pretty amazing for Lu Quan, right?
Totally unexpected. The king hears about Lu Quan's wife, Liquillian, and her suicide. He orders someone to check their records.
Afterlife admin.
Right. And it turns out both Lu Quan and his wife were actually destined to live long lives, maybe even become immortal. Her suicide was, like, against her fate.
So, an error in the system.
Or maybe just tragedy striking outside the plan. Anyway, the king decides to fix it. He wants to reunite them. But there's a problem.
What's the catch?
Heliopelian's physical body is gone. It decayed or whatever back in the living world.
Ah, bit of a logistical nightmare for a reunion. How do they solve that?
Well, the king of hell comes up with this. Let's call it a creative solution. He decrees that Liquillian's soul will be put into the body of Emperor Taizong's younger sister, Yi Li Yuying, who had just died. Apparently, she was fated to die young anyway.
Wait, what? They just transplant her soul into the princess's body.
That's the story. Raises all sorts of questions about souls and bodies, doesn't it?
It really does. So what happens back on Earth? Does the princess just wake up as someone else?
Pretty much. Yi Liu Ying appears to die, everyone's mourning her, and then suddenly she revives. But she's got Li Kuilian's memories, her personality, everything. She's confused by the palace surroundings, obviously.
I bet.
But when Li Quan is brought to see her, she instantly recognizes him as her husband.
That must have been a shock for everyone. How did the emperor handle that? His sister is suddenly claiming to be this other woman married to Li Quan.
Amazingly well, actually. The text praises his wisdom. He seems to understand what happened, accepts this extraordinary situation, and gives Li Quan and his wife, now in his sister's body, lots of gifts. He basically gives the whole thing his imperial blessing.
Wow, okay, that's quite a resolution. Destiny, intervention, body swapping, it got everything.
It really does.
So the story then moves on to tying up another loose end from the emperor's trip. The borrowed money. This involves Yu Qigong, right?
Yes, Yu Qigong, one of Taizong's most loyal generals. He gets the job of going to Huchu, Kaifeng Prefecture, to find this Xie Shenliang, the old man Shang who lent the money in the underworld, and pay him back the gold and silver.
So they track him down. What's he like in the living world?
They find him, and he's just a humble water seller, lives very simply with his wife, Zhangxi. And get this, they use their tiny earnings to do good deeds, mostly giving to Buddhist monks and burning symbolic paper money.
For the underworld.
Exactly, for the spirits. So without even knowing it, his quiet charity was building up massive good karma, even reaching the underworld rulers.
Huh. Small acts, big impact. So what happens when Yu Qigong shows up with a cartload of gold and silver?
Shang Liang is completely baffled, and he refuses to take it. Flat out refuses.
Refuses? Why? It's repayment.
He just can't believe it. He thinks it must be unclear money, like dodgy funds or something. Why would a poor water seller suddenly get this fortune? Even when Yu Qigong explains the whole underworld story, the emperor's debt, Judge Gui, Shang Liang is still hesitant. He's worried about bad luck or trouble coming with such unexpected wealth.
Wow, incredible integrity. Or maybe just extreme caution. So what does the emperor do if the guy won't take the money?
Taizong respects his wishes. Since Shang Liang won't take the cash, the emperor decrees that the money will be used to build a huge, magnificent temple in his honor.
A temple for the water seller.
Yes, named Chengqi Chengguosi. The imperial built Yangguo Temple, and also a Guo Shangxi, a living shrine dedicated to Shang Liang and his wife. Yu Qigong is put in charge of building it. And the text points out, this is the famous Cinch Great Shangguo Temple that still exists today.
No way. So that temple has its origins in this underworld loan story. Amazing.
Yeah, it turns a personal debt into this big public monument honoring quiet virtue.
Okay, so debts paid, souls swapped. The emperor can finally focus on the main task Judge Gui gave him, the Griyu, Water and Land Assembly. How does he get that started?
He issues a big public notice calling for the best monks virtuous, learned from all over the empire, to come to the capital, Chang'an, for this massive ceremony. It's meant to save countless souls, so it's a huge undertaking.
But setting up such a massive Buddhist event?
Yeah.
Did everyone at court agree with this? I seem to recall some opposition.
You're right, there was pushback, specifically from an official named Biu Fuyi. He was a staunch Confucian.
Ah, the Confucian critique.
Yeah.
What was his argument against it?
He wrote a formal memo, basically slamming the whole idea. He argued Buddhism messes up the proper social order. Yeah. The Confucian relationships, ruler-subject, father-son. He called Buddhist ideas like the six paths and karma just tricks to fool people.
Pretty strong words.
Oh, yeah. He said life, death, luck, that's all natural, depends on the ruler's virtue and heaven's will, not some foreign Buddhist gods. He pointed to ancient rulers who did fine without Buddhism, calling it alien and harmful to Chinese tradition.
Okay, so a fundamental clash of worldviews there. Did anyone defend Buddhism?
Absolutely. Xiao Yu, a top statesman who was also a devout Buddhist, stood up to Fuyi. He argued, no, Buddhism is good for the nation because it teaches people to do good and avoid evil, even if you don't see the immediate payoff.
The unseen benefits argument.
Right. He called the Buddha a great sage and said attacking his teachings was basically impious. He flipped Fuyi's argument, saying that rejecting Buddhist compassion actually means lacking core virtues like filial piety and loyalty.
So a real debate. Confucian values versus Buddhist principles. Were there any other opinions?
Yeah, a couple other officials, Ao Zhangdaoyuan and Zhu Zhangxing, tried to find a middle ground. They supported the idea of the three teachings, Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism, coexisting peacefully.
The syncretic approach.
Exactly. They mentioned past emperors who embraced all three, arguing they're all paths to wisdom and shouldn't be set against each other, trying to smooth things over.
So, faced with these different views, strong opposition, strong defense, calls for harmony. What does Emperor Taizong decide? Does the assembly go ahead?
He decides, yes, it goes ahead. He sides with proceeding with the Water and Land Assembly. It shows he clearly believed in its importance, likely influenced by his underworld trip.
Okay.
And he tells Wei Zheng, Xiao Yu, and Zeng Daoyuan, interestingly, representing different viewpoints, to work together to pick the absolute best monk for the job. Someone really virtuous and wise to be the putan, the altar master, the main guy leading the ceremony.
And he takes another step too, right? To protect Buddhism.
Yes. He issues another decree specifically saying, no slandering Buddhism or monks, basically putting imperial weight behind protecting the faith.
So the search is on for the perfect monk. Who do they choose for this incredibly important role?
After looking carefully, the choice falls on a monk named Chen Yuzhan.
Xuanzang. Now that's a name many people might recognize.
Indeed. And the text gives him this incredible backstory. It says he's the reincarnation of Jin Chan, who was supposedly a major disciple of the Buddha himself.
Wow, okay. A past life connection. What about his earthly background?
Also very impressive. Son of a top scholar, Cheng Wangri. Grandson of a big military commander, Yun Keshan. So high status lineage. But he apparently had a tough early life, became a monk young, and just excelled. Deeply understood all the scriptures, known for being incredibly virtuous.
Sounds like the perfect candidate, really. How does Taizong react when they propose Xuanzang?
He's delighted, absolutely thrilled with the choice, recognizes Xuanzang's qualities, and he gives him these huge titles. Tharsi, Left Buddhist Registrar, Right Buddhist Registrar, and even Ete, Grand Buddhist Registrar of the Nation.
Basically making him the head Buddhist official in the whole empire.
Pretty much. And he personally gives him gifts, a beautiful yor, kasaya, the monk's robe, and a special pilu hat, ceremonial headwear. It's a massive imperial endorsement.
So Xuanzang is appointed. He's got the emperor's full support. What are the final steps before this huge ceremony begins?
Xuanzang gets to work organizing everything at the Osheng Temple. He gathers 1,200 respected monks to take part. It's going to be a massive event. They set the date, September 3rd, to start the ceremony, which will last for 49 days.
49 days.
Yeah, a long, intensive ritual. And the emperor himself, along with the entire court, plans to be there for the opening. Shows just how significant this Water and Land Assembly was meant to be.
What an incredible chain of events, all starting from that one supposed journey to the underworld. It really ties everything together, spirituality, morality, imperial power.
Absolutely. That experience, real or legendary, becomes the catalyst for everything that follows. Promoting virtue, fixing injustices like Lu Kuan's, repaying debts even from the afterlife, and culminating in this massive religious undertaking. And those side stories like Lu Kuan and Li Quilian or Shang Ling, the water seller, they just perfectly illustrate the themes of karma and divine justice running through it all.
And for everyone listening, hoping to get a good grasp of this quickly but thoroughly, well, a clear look into this chapter, its insights into historical beliefs, how stories were told without getting bogged down. I mean, that detailed picture of the afterlife, the back and forth between the living and the dead.
Right, and the tangible results. Things happening on Earth because of underworld agreements. And Li Quilian's story, getting a new body, that's definitely one you don't forget easily. It really blends the supernatural and the everyday in a unique way.
Definitely memorable.
So as we wrap up, maybe something to think about is, why do these kinds of stories about the afterlife, about the consequences of our actions, have such lasting power across cultures, across time?
Yeah. What is it about them?
What are those deep questions about morality, about fate, about how things connect that these stories keep trying to answer for us even now? And what does this particular tale maybe suggest about the link between rulers, their actions, and the sort of spiritual health of their people?
Lots to chew on there. A rich story indeed.